EMS on the Mountain is an entertainment, educational, and commentary product recorded by Sean and Mike and produced by them. Nothing recorded by Sean, Mike, or any of the guests of the show is endorsed nor authorized by their respective employers or agencies unless explicitly outlined. All commentary and statements made are their own. Always follow your respective medical protocols. Nothing said on this platform should be considered medical direction. Now, on with the show.
Welcome to the EMS on the Mountain podcast, a show for those interested in austere and wilderness medicine. This podcast provides insight into the unique aspects and challenges of bringing modern EMS into wilderness and austere environments.
And we don't know what that is, but welcome back to another episode of EMS on the Mountain.
My precious.
And with us, as always, is Mike, and talking about his precious. Instead of art, it could be his precious. But today, we're going to talk about some more technical rescue stuff, but today focused primarily on personal equipment. So the things the individual rescuer is going to have on their harness and such. Mike is going to lead that as, we'll call him our duty resident expert.
All things turkey duty. All right. So we had a podcast a few weeks ago on general rescuey things. I think there's probably going to be a couple more. We've still got an interview that we want to get done with somebody as well. But one of the things we had promised our loyal listener was an overview of personal equipment vis-a-vis the stuff that you're actually using individually versus group equipment. I should probably start with, this is highly dependent on personal preference. And the only way you really make a good determination as to what your loadout should look like is largely driven by your mission profile and what you need to do. I've owned upwards of 20 some odd harnesses in my time, rescue harnesses, tree harnesses, climbing harnesses, custom built harnesses from a buddy of mine that manufactures and invents harnesses. There is no one perfect harness for anyone. There's no set of perfect gear for anyone. But I'm going to go ahead and piss off every logistics officer out there for every fire department right now. Buying a box full of the same shit because you got a deal on it because you bought 20 of the same fucking harness, this is not the time for uniformity in equipment. Harnesses are people-specific, they are mission-specific, and they're function-specific. And you can't just buy a box of 20 full-body fall-arrest harnesses and be like, all right, we're all set for tech rescue. Let's go do this. Especially anybody that's got a wilderness component, because a harness is way too big, it's way too heavy, and it's not very fun. Okay, so let's talk about harnesses. For my novices out there, I'm sorry, go ahead, Sean.
I'm just saying, snugger, the better.
The snugger, the better. Make it right.
There, okay, so I'm going to break this down in generalities. And I'll clarify this a little bit. This is going to be, if you are knowledgeable in tech rescue and rescuee type things, you can go ahead and ignore the first 2 to 3 minutes of this podcast, because this is going to be about harness types and function for individuals. And I'm going to try to use my words to describe very visual things. Sean's really good at the social medias, and he does most of our media socially. Plus, he's doing something to his wrist right now. I don't know what it's some sort of shoulder exercise.
Theraball, not tensible.
Theraball, yeah. You're the best, old man. He'll probably post some pictures of the things I'm talking about here. But here it goes. So first off, harnesses used in rescue-type scenarios basically come in seat harness style or full-body harness style. And there's a couple of things in the market. I can think of two of them made by Petzl, and I know Yates makes something similar, that are intended to take a seat harness and turn it into a full-body harness for the purpose of full-bodying. As a general rule of thumb, we probably don't need full-body harnesses in wilderness rescue. Now, a whole bunch of people are losing their mind right now. By a whole bunch, I mean four. Because we currently teach in the course that Sean and I are instructors for, we teach that you must wear a full-body harness if you are attached to the Stokes, because heaven forbid, you could fall and break your back.
Technically, you must have a chest harness that is connected to your leg harness.
Which makes it a full body harness. Like,
sort of, yeah.
He's not wrong. It's just, I'm going to avoid
splitting.
Yes. So full body harnesses, while awesome and everybody says are the safest, they have a couple of drawbacks. One is your master point is up in your chest, which is typically in a wilderness and austere environment needed for other things. And two, it's just too much harness for the job. Now, when we get into seat harnesses, sitting style, or the waist and the leg loops pieces of the puzzle, there's really three, what I think of them as three different styles. And I'm going to get some terminology wrong like I do on every podcast, but here we go. You have climbing style harnesses that have a sewn belay loop. You have high speed, high drag, heavy rescue harnesses that have a built-in steel ring on them. And there are a few harnesses out there that follow what I will call the climbing style low master point. And it's usually a D-ring type carabiner or locking device that holds both sides of the harness together. To be a little more clear, caving harnesses, in particular, purpose-built caving harnesses, have a low master point. I'm going to actually Google it right now. They have a low master point with a tri-directional. I think that's what they're called, tri-lock.
That's
That might be
kind of a manufacturer-specific type one.
Yeah, that might be Pat's name.
Yeah, it is.
But
the various things. The big D-shaped ones is what we're talking about, folks.
Yeah, they look like big D's.
and those will, I'll have a bunch of pictures and I'll show you. Because I've got, like, Mike, all of those things.
Yeah, he owns all the things. I've broken him. He owns all the things.
Not as many as this dude, just so we're clear.
Yeah, I've got a house worth of hardware. Actually, Petzl calls it a demi-rond.
It's because it is a half round.
It is. It's a semicircle aluminum alloy quick link. But the important takeaway here, and once you start looking at pictures of harnesses, you're going to be like, oh, I get what he's talking about. The master point, if you're wearing the harness, the master point actually sits just below the waistline, like above the pubic synthesis on the humans. Because in a climbing environment, you want to get as much what's called throw as possible, especially when you're ascending long rope. This, in my opinion, is an awesome setup for multifunctional rescue work, but you have to understand that it lowers your center of gravity to the point where if you end up hanging from your harness in a free-hanging environment, you will invert. Like, it's just going to happen because your master point is so low. All of your upper body weight is above the master point at which you're attached to the rope. The second style we'll talk a little bit about is what I call the master rescuey thingy. Master heavy rescue, heavy weighted, go for broke, hardcore harness. These harnesses often have a ring sewn into the harness. It's a metal ring that's sewn into the harness, but that ring sits above the waistline of the harness. So it's typically, they flop. It's a horrible description, but they flop. The big takeaway here, the big kicker here is this harness is designed so that you cannot remove or in any way compromise the master attachment point from the leg loops and the waist belt of the harness. There's a number of different brands out there that make these. This is what you will typically see as a setup on a quote-unquote traditional rescue style harness. They have a point of attachment at the waist, just above the waist, and it's usually always some sort of steel or aluminum ring that is sewn into the harness. These are fine for hoisting and fall arrest type functions, per se. They typically, not always, but they typically have large back support. They're made to be sat in for long periods of time. Often, the leg loops will be big and beefy. And again, they're fine for fall arrest and general work in the woods. The kicker here is it's hard to wear anything else with them. It's hard to have anything else on with them. And if you need to be able to move on rope as opposed to being moved around with rope, I can speak more to that if y'all want me to. Or Sean gives me the look on the camera like, yeah, you should talk about that, buddy.
Hey, we might talk about that later.
They suck for moving on rope because your point of attachment to the rope is so high that it also cants a lot of equipment in a bad way. They're just not the best if you need to climb rope or rappel on your own. And then the third style, as I mentioned a minute ago, is a climbing style harness. There are harnesses made by various manufacturers that have the climbing belay loop built in. It's sewn into them, as opposed to a climbing harness where it's typically attached just to the leg loops. There are a few harnesses out there where it's attached to both the leg loops and the waist with multi-redundant connectivity thingies. It's fine. If that's what you have, I have no qualm with them. Again, they do get a little, they're better for rappel, but they do get a little wonky when it comes to climbing because, again, your attachment point to the rope is higher than it would be on a caving style harness. But if I had to choose, I'd choose one of these over something with a D-ring on it for wilderness work. They also tend to have thinner backs. Climbing harnesses are made for fall arrest. They are not made for sitting in for long periods of time. So if you have a rescue harness that's got a more climbing aspect to it, typically they will have smaller leg loops. The back padding tends to be smaller. The one thing to keep in mind with climbing style harnesses, at least most of them, right, there's a couple exceptions out there, you cannot disconnect the leg loops, which makes donning and doffing your equipment sometimes a pain in the ass because you can't unbuckle the leg loops and put it on standing. You have to step through them. And if it's an environment where you already have other equipment on, sometimes it's a pain in the ass. But in general, my preferences for most things is going to be caving style harness, then a climbing style harness, and then if I have to, the big master point. Now, every firefighter that's listening to this, so all one of you, or number one listener, is going to say, yeah, but they make me wear these things. And that's often the case, right? Do not go breaking the rules of your agency because you heard some guy wax poetic because he knew a thing or two about harnesses. But in general, those are my preferences. Sean, should I mention tree harnesses?
I would say, you know.
Okay. So we're not going to talk about tree harnesses.
Yeah. And he's talking about, harnesses specifically designed for arborists, which, I would leave those out. It's
okay.
If you're familiar with an arborist harness and everything else and rescue work, this probably episode is for you. But for those people who've never seen what an arborist harness looks like, Google it. Maybe we'll put a picture up when we do our social media stuff.
Yeah. They have a thing called a bridge. You can turn a lot of harnesses into tree style harnesses.
They're just
the big thing is this bridge that allows you to lean left and right.
Yeah.
But we don't have to talk about just it because we said.
Yeah. You don't see those very often in the rescue environment.
No. Unless you're mean.
You don't see them. Most certainly. Yeah. It's very, very slow.
Or Mr. Eddie. He rocks them. And I will tell you right now. So if anybody's, holy crap, this is already too much noise. I don't understand what they're talking about. This is not an endorsement of Petzl per se, though they do make great equipment. Their Falcon line of harnesses is like the ultimate example of what I'm talking about. They make something called a Falcon Ascent and a Falcon Mountain. And it almost lines up directly with what I'm saying. The Falcon Ascent is like a sit harness for suspending. It's got the big steel ring on it, but it would be horrible for climbing a rope. The Falcon Ascent is the same harness, but the master point where you attach uses the D-ring like a caving harness so that you get the point of attachment as low as possible. And the Falcon Mountain is a traditional climbing style harness made for fall arrest on rope when moving horizontally or vertically, but it's got a traditional belay rappel loop on it. Like, it's almost like Petzl knew that there were three types of harnesses needed in this world, and they wanted you to give them $250 times three just in case you needed to be. But if you look up Falcon, like the bird, Petzl makes variations of the same harness for different purposes, and it's right there in the descriptions, and it aligns with what I'm saying. You have the master point, which is a fall arrest. You've got climbing style harness for, they say it's for alpine lightweight things, and then the Falcon Ascent is really the one that you want with a low master point for the purpose of ascending.
Oh,
all right, that was a lot in 9 minutes of talking. Sean, anything else I missed around harness styles before I talk about what's best for what?
I would say no.
Okay.
Go
ahead. So let's.
Nothing. That's just going to say, putting some pictures and labeling some of these things to folks. Like, we might have a couple of days worth of social media posts with some more detailed descriptors of some of this stuff.
Dude, I'm here to hook you up, buddy. Okay. So now that I've talked about the three styles, we need to talk a little bit about mission profile and harness decision-making criteria. For me personally, I won't wear a harness. I shouldn't say I won't. I largely prefer not to wear a harness in the rescue environment. Like specifically, like I'm going to go do some rescue stuff. I prefer to not use harnesses, or I prefer to only use harnesses that have detachable leg loops. I really like to be able to put my harness on and get the waist secured and then attach my leg loops. Climbing, traditional climbing harnesses, almost none of them have that capability. They're all about stepping into the loops. And it's just, I don't know if it's because I'm getting old. It's a lot of things. But I like to be able to detach my leg loops if possible, or pull them to one side so I can walk in the harness horizontally for a period of time, or wear a harness on a long operation without having to have the leg loops around my legs for the entire operation. I also like the fact that you're just not standing on a rock face somewhere stumbling and bumbling, and I can adjust those leg loops and put other clothing on over them, have puffier clothes on in the winter. Like, it just gives me flexibility. The other thing you want to think about is the back padding. Any professional style harness is going to be made with additional or larger padding along the back of the harness than would a traditional climbing harness or even a caving harness. In fact, many very popular caving style harnesses do not even have padding. It's just a strip of nylon. It's super low profile, minimalist harness that sits below the iliac crest almost. Not the iliac crest. The top of the hips. What? Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Correct.
I don't know why I was having a brain moment there. I'm a paramedic, everybody. They're super thin and typically low profile, lightweight. It's largely so you don't get hung up climbing through things. And if you don't need it, why have all that extra padding? The converse is you want to make sure that if you're going to be sitting in your harness or wearing it for any extended period of time, you don't develop a number of hot spots or uncomfortable pressure points. That's why the wider the padding, the bigger the padding, the more comfortable the harness. This is one of those moments where I started this podcast with, boys and girls, you can't say that everything is go buy 20 harnesses of the same style. It's just not going to work. Different people prefer different levels of comfort. There's totally different aspects to how comfortable a particular harness is going to be for what your mission profile is. And in general, some harnesses, they're like shoes. Like some harnesses fit different people differently, gooder and better, right? I'm fluffy, so I need a harness that's going to tolerate my gut status. Whereas Sean is just twisted steel and sex appeal, and he can get away with wearing a super slim harness because he doesn't have all that man gut that I do. Any other thoughts on that, Sean?
I know you
always rock the detachable leg loops, but
I did have my lovely favorite harness until about, I was 8.
By the way, if my teacher harness, don't use it. No matter how much, don't use it.
And the good news is they only those parts that would be considered like life support, like stitching and stuff that actually held the harness together, left like leg padding alone in shape. But it had Astra out there and Cobra quick release little leg loops so that I could pop it off and on nice and smooth.
Wonderful.
But I'm back to myself, a tradition just climbing harness. But the only thing I would say is if you're looking for a harness with all the extra lumbar and leg padding and stuff, you got to keep in mind that it makes it bigger. Doesn't make it a whole lot heavier, but it makes it bigger. And if you have to pack your harness into a backpack to take it to a rescue, that is a consideration you need to think about. Walking with your harness on for extended periods, it sucks. And always try to avoid it if possible. So it's just one more consideration in choosing your harness. But if you're, you get to a lot of your rescues on a vehicle and you don't have to carry things very far. You don't have to backpack all of your kit at once yourself. You could pull it out of your UTV or a truck, don it, walk a little bit, and then you're doing some big wall stuff where you might be suspended for a long period of time working through the problem. Yeah, probably a good choice. Just like Mike was saying, if your mission profile fits that type and that need, absolutely. Vice, if you're on there for a very little time and you're not going to be suspended, or your weight truly suspended on your harness, then you could probably get away with one of those caving harnesses that have zero padding on it. But from experience, that's not something you want to hang in for. I wouldn't even want a half hour of that thing because it starts to bite into you a lot quicker than things.
Yeah, it sounds miserable. And then now, like, Helitech crews and helo operators are going to full body style as well. So again, your mission profile is going to dictate some of your gear selection. But in general, for wilderness stuff that we focus on this podcast, I'm not a fan of a huge harness.
No.
Okay. So we've covered harness selections. I will tell you, if you're going to ascend rope, having a chest harness or a full body harness with the master point up at the sternum, it's going to make climbing rope almost impossible. Doable, but almost impossible.
Moving 6 inches at a shot.
Yep. Pretty much. All right. Let's talk about helmets. This is one of my favorite topics. Helmets are extremely purpose-built for the helmet function in which you're going to use it. So buying a climbing harness and expecting it to protect you from sideways impacts or tripping and falling and landing on your face, it ain't going to happen. But again, this is another weight factor thing. I think of climbing helmets largely as like bump and rock fall protection, and that's about it. They don't do a great job of keeping you alive if you're going to fall 30 feet. I don't think any harness or helmet would. But I am not a fan of climbing style harnesses for wilderness work. The main reason is twofold. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Sean.
You keep saying harness and we're talking helmet.
Yeah, I'm tired. And I ran a lot of calls yesterday, and I'm largely a failure as a human. So we're talking about helmets now. And I am not a fan of climbing style helmets for rescue work. A lot of teams do it. I understand. 50% of those teams that are doing it is because their supply guy got a good deal on helmets. Almost said harnesses, see? About myself. But the attachment points are shit. Most people don't realize that glue and other adhesives on a helmet actually degrade the plastic, making the helmet less useful. And most of the time you want to be able to attach headlamps and other things, and you want protection from falling trees or horizontal bumps or bangs or hitting your head on a rock or being on a rock face and swinging sideways and cracking your noggin. Climbing helmets just aren't awesome for that. Oh, what's the brand of the helmet that like everyone's wearing now? I can't think of it.
Team Wendy
makes an awesome helmet. They actually make a SAR style helmet. Again, this isn't a Team Wendy thing, though if Team Wendy wants to sponsor us, I'm happy to have a conversation.
Very happy.
The helmet extends more than a couple of inches from the side of the head, which gives you protection from horizontal knocking around as well. Most of their helmet styles offer, how do I describe it? The two-strap chin bucket thing versus just under the chin sort of protection so that the helmet stays on if you get slung in a side-to-side manner. What am I missing? Oh, and attachment points for various accessories, lights, ear protection, et cetera, et cetera. The next best thing, if you're not interested in something like that or you don't want to spend the money, would be like an arborist style harness or a helmet that has like the capability to put a visor on it to keep brush and things out of the eyes. Most of the time, a lot of these helmets are based on NVG mount things. I don't see anybody like running around the woods with it. He's doing rescue, but it looks cool.
Look cool doing it.
Yeah. And that's really the name of the game. You got to look cool doing it. Look for a helmet that's going to give you protection from side impact and impact to the rear of the head, as well as just top impact. A lot of climbing helmets are made for rock fall, rock getting kicked loose by a climbing partner above you. They are not made for
lateral
impact smash protection, right? Like a Team Wendy has enough buffer to it that for most people, the lip of the helmet on the front sticks out just slightly further than the nose on the face. Whereas if you look at a climbing harness, it does not. I've actually had a Team Wendy helmet protect me when I took a swing toward a rock. I put my head down a little bit and bounced my helmet off the rock because my hands were busy. Anyway, that's about... Is there anything else you want to say about helmets, Sean?
Because helmets, like...
I don't want it to feel...
So you're going to... You have two choices.
You know,
you're going to use a traditional climbing helmet of choice, which, again, is probably 90-some percent of most teams out there, or you're going to have to invest considerably more money and something like OpsCore or a Team Wendy style multi-impact rated helmets. But those are, they're not cheap. The protection's excellent.
I thought not.
Kyle. Mike and I both use Team Wendy helmets just because we find they're more multi-purpose helmet. A lot more teams are finding use for them, especially if they have, you work like swift water plus climbing a vertical because they're rated for swift water, they're rated for vertical. Yeah, the integration you could do with hearing protection, communications. So if you work with helicopters a lot, it's that style is becoming a lot more popular, but it also, you can probably buy what, like 4 regular climbing helmets for the cost of one.
Yeah, at least 2 or 3. Like a Team Winnie helmet is going to run you close to $400. And that starts to get real pricey for teams need a lot of helmets. They have a large number of people on their crew. So it cost is a consideration, but I am not personally a big, huge fan of, I'm not a great big fan of using climbing helmets for rescue work. I think there's better, more purpose-built equipment out there for that purpose. And with that, I will stop talking about helmets. All right. Next on my list, gloves. You would think that people would understand that I'm just talking about gloves. It is amazing to me the number of things I see. First off, it is worth note that gloves are a very individualized thing. But there's a couple of functions around rope work that we have to take into consideration. One, these old school leather gloves that certain agencies still have a hard-on for, you lose all of your dexterity. They protect your hands from moving rope, but there's also other ways to protect your hands from moving rope. Don't grab it. Turns out that moving rope does not necessarily require a whole lot of thought around it. We're using mechanical devices more and more today to manage the friction. If a rope is ripping through your hand, you're probably doing it wrong. I prefer the mechanics wear style gloves or something a little thicker. I'm not going to say that you need to go buy mechanics wear gloves for rope work. Petsa makes great gloves. Magpul makes great gloves. There's a lot of great gloves out there, but they have a relatively thin palm. Even when I'm rappelling, if the rope is moving through my hand with my relatively thin leather palmed glove on, and my hand is getting too hot to handle the heat, I'm going too fast. Because that also means that everything else in my system, right, my aluminum descension device, everything else is also collecting a certain amount of heat, and heat is bad for nylon ropes. The days of Australian rappelling with an MP5, a la best Christmas movie ever, I can't think of the name of it now, Die Hard, when they're like trying to save the day, we're not doing that shit. We're just not. So I do not like big, chunky gloves. This is completely going to be agency policy directed. So if your policy, your agency says you've got to have a lot of agencies still use the language protective leather gloves. And I see so many people that go get like the big old school yellowish tan leather gloves. Like,
yeah, no shit. Leather work gloves.
Right, leather work gloves.
Yeah.
And then they try to do rope work in them. And it's fine. Like those are fine for the moving rope aspect. But you lose dexterity. You're doing it all day or you're running along extradition or extrication. I often find that they get sweaty and gross inside. And then you get blisters. And the number of people I see trying to tie knots and do relatively dainty functions without their dexterity, just it appalls me. Like wear a glove that allows you to maintain a certain level of dexterity or take your gloves off, do some work, put them back on. Now that I've completely shit on gloves that everyone else wears for all of the things they do, this is completely mission specific. If we're talking about an alpine environment or you're on a winter expedition, yeah, you should probably be wearing gloves that are going to maintain thermal control of your hands. Frostbite sucks more than wearing crappy gloves. But again, a lot of people will take their gloves off, tie the knot, put the gloves back on. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it here, but if you're in an environment where taking your gloves off even for a minute are going to cause problems, you probably know what the hell you're doing already. So we don't.
I hope so.
Not here. Yeah, or you're getting frostbite. One of the two.
Yeah. You're learning a lesson quickly.
Yeah, not here to judge, right? It's an opportunity for education. All right. Anything else on gloves from your point of view, Sean?
No, not really, other than whenever you're in the rescue environment, you should always have a pair of gloves with your kit. Just, it should just be like with your harness, your helmet, have gloves.
Or 2 pair in case you drop a set. Also, tether important things or clip them properly. Mm. Do not stick them in pockets.
Yeah.
Okay. I want to spend a minute talking about glasses. This seems like a thing that we wouldn't really care about in a rope rescue environment. And I will be the first one to admit I violate my own rules often, but I'm just a bad person. We already knew that. I take the same approach to eye protection working in these austere environments that I would for range purposes. I want some sort of ballistic protection, typically glasses that'll wrap around the side of my eyes, not just be a flat lens on the front. And I gotta tell you, I'm a big fan of glasses in general because when your hands are tied up doing other things, or you're in a vertical environment, or you're working in other stuff, it's hard to protect your eyes. Even walking through the woods at night, back when I used to do much more traditional search and rescue work, you would inevitably get schwacked in the face by a tree trunk or a tree limb, or trip over a tree trunk and eat shit. Glasses are important. I didn't want to harp on glasses. I don't have a whole lot to say about glasses other than you should be keeping this in mind. Rope work often gets talked about as being low speed, but protecting your eyes from moisture, rocks, dust, dirt, stuff from helicopters, whatever the case may be, it's an important aspect. Sean, you have any opinion on glasses, or should I just move on to goes ups and goes down to this?
The only caveat I'll add is in my SAR pack, I have my safety glasses. And for those of us, as my doctors now tell me, gentlemen of a certain age, my safety glasses are also bifocal, right? Because I need a reading lens. And so I can be out looking at normal stuff, but then if I have to look down to read things or start an ID or something, I have that bifocal lens and I can still do IVs, read med vials, et cetera. So for my friends that require vision support, there you can get some Oakley M frames. I don't know if they still make those. Give them to be free. You can get prescription lenses and pretty much anything. And if you're like me, you just need some readers with bifocal lenses, you can order these things off Amazon amongst other places. And they're legit safety glasses manufacturers that make them.
They do, in fact, still make M frames.
I see. But I haven't bought Oakley since for a long time now. So it's like we're giving them to me free. I don't buy Oakley's anymore. Or Benjamin knives, yeah, knives, all the good stuff. Youth is good. Anyway, so yeah, so don't let vision problems say that these are good. And regular eyeglasses don't always make for good eye protection necessarily, right?
That's true.
So your normal glasses you wear every day may or may not suffice. So don't take your vision for granted, I guess, is bottom line.
I don't currently wear one. I'm actually thinking about going to one. But today I don't have a visor on my helmet, but there are some SAR teams and rescue folks that really swear by that. Some teams require it, especially so you can wear like sunglasses under them and take sunglasses off and still have the clear visor, or they get tinted visors like flight helmets that give more round protection. In general, I don't have the visor on my helmet. I've thought about buying one and playing with it. I've worn one a couple of times. I didn't love them. But eye protection is important, especially if you're working around helicopters.
I was going to say, if I did more helicopter-centric work, I would absolutely put a visor on my helmet. It's so much easier.
Yeah. I the main reason I don't wear one is it gets in the way of the mount for my headlamp.
And that's incidental helicopter exposure. I have my normal safety glasses for all of that. And then, yeah, I want to have my headlamp mounted there. That's at the point, which with the helmets that we're currently wearing, more allowed. There are some SAR helmets that are out there that have the visor built in inside the shell, which are handy, which I don't own one of those helmets, but those are out there. So that is an option if that's something they're looking for, is to always have that built-in iPro. It's not bad.
All right, let's move on to hardware. I could spend hours talking about this. Let me start with a general statement, and then we're going to talk about pros and cons of classes of equipment. First off, this becomes very mission specific and individual rescuer specific. Sean and I have tethers, and we have ascension devices, and we have descension devices, and we have foot loops that go along with ascension and whatnot. And as a general statement, we're going to talk about each of those. As a general statement, we'll talk about categories. I will give you a few specifics on my opinion on certain ascension and descension devices. For example, Sean uses a very popular climbing device made by a very popular climbing company. I can't stand the damn thing for rescue. So it kind of depends. I will tell you that there are programs that I'm affiliated with now that teach the RAD device or the RAD methodology, the rapid access and rapid ascension and descension technique.
There we go.
I can't stand it. I think it's dangerous. But it is easier, and I will admit that.
The only good thing about that is if you started off going down, which is what you hate, I'm happy to, obviously.
You got to get up to get down, Sean.
You're coming down to your patient, and for whatever reason, you got to do a small ascent. then that's perfect, right? You put it on, you back up another 5 feet, reposition something, and you keep going. And I would 100% agree with you. If you're doing a full 60 plus foot something ascension, way better with things to dig in that. So for all you rad fans, I would say we don't completely poo-poo it. We just view it as a very small use case thing. It's not very efficient for long distance ascents.
Yeah, that's right.
Especially if you're having to do that with weight. If you are helping to ascend with a person attached to you, it makes it even harder.
Anyway. True. Very true. Okay. So let's talk about GoDownza's gear first. For all of you gray-haired party people or 50% of the firefighters listening, because the fire department takes forever to modernize, unless you work for a major metro agency like around me, figure eights and rescue eights are largely going the way of the dodo. They've been around forever. They're a great old school piece of equipment. They are relatively stump simple. They're also not the safest and pretty hard on your gear. They're going away. If you still use them, it's fine. I have a general rule for the wilderness rescue work I do that if you're going to be able to go down, you have to be able to go up. If you're going to go up, you have to be able to go down. Transferring weight onto or off of a figure eight style device. And I'm not talking to regular eight, I'm talking to rescue eight with the ears. It's just harder. And the propensity for things to go wrong or somebody end up unconscious. And look, I am not going to be, what's the favorite saying we like to say, Sean? Oh my gosh, it's amazing. The trees didn't disappear this time, right? Everybody talks about having things being quadruple redundant in case the anchor goes away, but I've never seen a tree like magically disappear or just fall over. So in that same vein, having a rescuer on rappel that suddenly gets knocked out from some event, like while possible, highly unlikely. But figure eight in general, my big thing with figure eights is they're hard. They're difficult to transfer weight onto or off of when you're trying to change from an ascent to a descent or vice versa on mid rope. So I'm not a huge fan of them. The other thing I am not a huge fan of, coming back to Sean's chosen device, purpose-built thingies, I'm not opposed to using climbing devices, assuming they're rated for them, for rescue as a general statement, but I'm not a big fan of any descension device that you have to disconnect from your harness to put the rope in or out of.
To be fair, you don't have to disconnect my descension device from my harness.
I thought you were using a Grigri.
No, I just bring one of those for students.
Okay.
So there.
Uh-huh. What are you using, a rig?
Stop. The K-version of a Grigri, basically.
Yep. It predates the Grigri. They've been making stops for...
Yeah. But I can six new one.
Yeah. Stops are fine. I use a thing called the DSD from Singing Rock. Big fan of that. Petzl rigs, Petzl ASAPs.
No.
I'm sorry, not ASAP.
ID.
ID. Petzl IDs. Trango makes some good gear. I mentioned Singing Rock before. There's a bunch of different devices out there that don't require you to disconnect it from the harness. And this is a thing. I don't really, if you like a particular device, I'm not going to fight you on it. We teach with some people that get really persnickety about particular devices or not devices. I am not persnickety about the device that you choose to use, but I personally am persnickety about the fact that in the dark at 2 o'clock in the morning, when it's raining on me slightly and it's 37 degrees and it's crappy out, I don't want to risk dropping my descent device while I'm trying to get it on or off rope in a vertical environment. So I prefer to attach my descent device to my harness and never, ever, never, ever detach it again. It's just a way to protect myself. Can I tie a Munter for all of you? Like, our number one fan is going to be, well, damn, I can't tie a Munter. Yeah, that's true. I can't. For to save his life. No, I can't. It's horrible. No, I could certainly get myself out of the problem, but I don't want to problem solve. I want to go execute the mission. And for me, any descent device that requires being detached from my harness is fine. Now, let's talk about descent device types. The world is basically moved, more or less. Hold on. Good. I'm just going to plow through with this. The world is mostly moved to what's referred to as a bobbin device. And what's a bobbin device?
Most of them use your rope will thread through a couple of points. Usually one is a camming device so that when not activated, camming lever comes up and pinches your rope and sends it, stops you, downward progress. Mm-hmm. Most have an activation lever. So when you activate the lever, the cam is basically released and allows your rope to flow.
There's a calculation out there. I can't exactly remember what it is, but it's something like brake equals rope plus belay plus weight of rescuer divided by some sort of math equation that gets you to a friction coefficient of the ability of moving the rope over multiple angles or bobbins.
Yeah.
Produces enough friction that it keeps you from reaching terminal velocity and finding the ground quickly. Under the same principle, right? When you put a bend in the rope, you produce friction. Friction slows down your motion. That's really the gist. Pretty much every descent device out there right now is based on that same principle. What's the other one that you use often or used to use often? The spidery looking thing.
The scarab?
Scarab. Scarabs and brake racks are based on the same principles, but they bend the rope. Or an ASAP or a rig or a gree-gree, right? You're putting a bend in the rope and camming it. That's really what you're doing. I don't have an opinion per se, one over the other, unless there's mission-specific variables that need to be brought into play. For example, sandy environments will chew up pretty much anything like a brake rack where you're running it over the bars. You will quickly notice that sand it'll act like sandpaper, and it will start eroding the bars on a brake rack. It'll put divots in figure eights pretty quick. So maybe bobbiny type devices might be a little better, but they eat the friction too. And the converse side is typically there's a cam in most of these modern devices, and that cam can get mucked up with sand and muck in those environments. Wet environments like rappelling in waterfalls and such are much better served with a bobbin style device than racks. They tend to work better on wet ropes, so to speak. Mm-hmm. You know, you may have other requirements. For example, some SAR or insertion type organizations want something that when you let go, it gets loose enough, the rope will run freely through it so that you can run off the end of a rope as opposed to disconnect from the rope. I think that's largely gone away, but it is a consideration, right? For example, a DSD that I use cams up real nicely if you pull on it and let go. So you can get quote unquote knocked out or let go with your hands and the device will stop. But if you want to be able to keep moving, you can't let go of the device. I can't think of anything that's real. Like figure eight's the old school, get out of the end of it, right? That was its bread and butter, so to speak. The other thing about go down devices, climbing type devices for going down and rescue. I'm not going to go super deep into weight ratings, but there's a lot of things you can do to mitigate patient weight if you have to extricate someone. It's not as easy to do in traditional climbing type devices, or you run the risk of overloading type devices for rescue work. We just tend to have more weight, right? I'm not hanging out with my buddies, like smoking a spliff and climbing a rock on a Saturday wearing my tight little rubber shoes. I've got 30 pounds of gear on me. And it needs to come with me. Climbing devices tend to not do as well with extrication, patient pickoffs, things like that. But again, to each their own. Like I keep an old school ASAP style device on my harness sometimes, just in case I need a second thing to do some rigging with. They actually work okay. Or if I need to lower something, they work great. But for pickoffs, don't love them.
Yeah, it's... Any of those other friction devices like that are not the best rescuer because most of them, where the rope feeds through to pinch it, they're not made for the thicker diameter ropes still in use in rescue, right? They're made for the smaller ropes diameters currently used for climbing. That's something you need to think about because we've seen students come through. It's like, hey, this is what I want to use for my descent today, doing different fells in school. And they have a hard time even getting that. And we still use some bigger 11 mil ropes through that device and they're on a carabiner area, then they have to like almost manually feed it to get it to float through when they're right. So it's a good backup as an additional thing for maybe just a little bit. You're doing some steep earth, little just fall arrest stuff. Perfect piece of kit. That's why I use a scarab or keep on with the because I can lower a full load with it because I can adjust the friction on it. But it's not my primary personal going down device usually, but it's a good piece of kit. It's, but it's not small and it's not light. I have the steel one. Maybe I'll get forward and buy the titanium one, but probably
no, not. You probably won't. You're getting too old for this anyway, Sean.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll take the feedback from the three people that send us messages. If you want more details on various vendors, I'm happy to give you my pros and cons thoughts on a lot of different things, but I also don't want to wax poetic for another 20 minutes about particular manufacturers, particular devices, and my personal opinion on them when it's not really going to serve anybody any good. And I want you to form your own opinions and spend an entire house worth of
spend all the money we have trying out different devices. You owe this thing a shit and meat to get rid of it.
So. Exactly. Also, I didn't mention this to begin with, but I'll say it now. Don't buy used hardware.
Oh, yeah.
No. Facebook Marketplace is not the place to find your rescue equipment. Life safety equipment does not get purchased on the used market. It's just the way it is.
If the life you save just might be your own.
Yeah, that's a good point. All right, let's talk about going up rope real quickly. I can divide techniques into a couple of different categories. If anybody's ever heard of the Yosemite Big Wall climbing style, you're welcome to Google it. Sean may drop a link to pictures somewhere. It really excels if you're up against a flat or almost vertical wall. Frog type systems are another very popular methodology. They tend to work best on free hanging rope, especially with purpose built equipment. If you are not doing that much ascending, if this isn't the primary mission spec of yours, a couple of handled ascenders, proper tethers to your harness, and a couple of foot loops, that's all you're going to need, like $250 worth of gear. If you're climbing rope a lot, it is probably worth spending some time dialing in or perfecting exact length of tethers and foot loops and all of these things to maximize for efficiency. Just for everyone that's listening, I use a frog system most of the time. I use a chest ascender with a handled ascender. That tends to be more efficient. It just makes it easier to climb the rope. This is part of the reason I had such an opinion on harnesses at the beginning of the podcast, because it's just to use a chest ascender or to use a body ascender, a chest ascender, is really hard in a harness that doesn't have a low point attachment point, and you get a really tiny, what's called a throw. There's no good way to explain this, but your throw is basically the distance you get between your upper attachment point and your lower attachment point to the rope. And the further your lower attachment point is up your body, right, up the abdomen and toward the chest, the closer that distance is to your left or right hand, depending, fully extended from above your head. And you want that distance to be as large as possible, to be as efficient as possible in every motion. Because climbing rope it takes energy, right? It's not like a walk in the park.
Yeah.
So by using a chest ascender that's down at my waist level, it gives me a longer throw, allowing to me to have more efficient movement of the rope. Now, what's the con here? One con is that this stuff tends to be expensive. You need some purpose-built equipment that really only works for one job. And it's largely a niche problem. In the wilderness world, we largely say you should not be going down a rope unless you can go back up the rope. You should be able to self-extricate. I won't talk about it here, but I will say that I personally believe that attendance attached to the stokes in 2024 is a thing we should not be doing anymore. I believe it puts too much load on the systems. I think there's better ways to extricate patients and still provide good patient care that doesn't include tying two or three people's body weights to a single rescue system. Come at me in the comments, please. Tell me I'm wrong. But I will sum it up this way. I will say that two handled ascenders is a minimum, regardless of the climbing system you're using, because a handled ascender alone is about useless for things like edge transitions or using it as a safety tether. You need a second handled ascender. So I'm going to go with one left hand, one right hand. Pick your favorite vendor. I don't really care. I have Singing Rock handled ascenders. I have Petzl handled ascenders. I have Black Diamond handled ascenders. Some of them are a little more efficient at this, that, and the other, but in general, just basic handled ascenders, one for each hand, and a couple of foot loops and a couple of tethers is all you need to climb rope. If you want to get specialized into chest ascenders, optimizing for throw, or you're going to be doing it a lot, then I would look at chest ascension systems. I still recommend carrying the two-handled ascenders. A lot of people tell you you only need one. I like having a second. The big one for wilderness rescue is when your upper handled ascender meets the edge of the lip that you're climbing up over. It's really nice to have another handled ascender attached to your harness that you can reach over the top of the lip and attach to the rope, and then remove the lower handled ascender and climb over the edge or the lip. There's a bunch of other uses for two-handled ascenders as well, but two-handled ascenders and maybe a chest ascender. Chest ascender is going to be dependent on the type of harness you're wearing. Sean, what am I missing?
Oh, I think we can
loop things, but
yeah, for my old school people, and you want to keep it ultra light and ultra compact, so you can go traditional like 2 Persic sit-ups. But if you've ever ascended a rope on just Persic, you will never do that again. It's certainly you can do it. You get practice at it. You can get efficient with it, but not for the rescue. Right. You need to have some kit that's on your harness that's going to do the job much more efficiently. I think the only thing I would add to ascender, descender, or up and down hardware is keep in mind the diameter of the rope you're working with. So if you're buying a certain descension device because it's the current hotness in the climbing community, but you're using thicker ropes rated for rescue, you might find that it doesn't work or it doesn't fit at all, because a lot of rescue places are still using at least an 11 mil, some 11.5, some places are still going all the way to full half inch 12.5. Those are out there, and most sport climbing descending devices are not going to fit in that. Even some new modern handle descenders aren't made to fit a 12 mil rope. It might get in there, but just barely. So keep in mind the diameter of the rope you're going to be using when you're selecting your gear.
That's
really not to that.
I didn't even talk about diameters at all. And we didn't really get into ropes at all, but that is an important aspect to keep in mind. Diameter of rope is directly proportional or affected by the device type you were using, or vice versa.
The amount of friction going over those bobbins, the bars, whatever it is, it all changes between. And a lot of people, when I talked about this to other people who are familiar with it, and so I have a mind valve that's more personal, just patient access rope. It's rated well. You could do a light rescue according to the specific manufacturer.
The hell is all?
But my device
is that like a half rescue? Like we're going to.
I think it's one of those that are not going to want you to put 50 pounds on it.
Gotcha.
And for me, it's primarily my patient access rope. And it's 9 mil. It's smaller. It's more compact. It's a lot lighter. And I know my VSET device is rated to go down just below a 9 mil. So it will still function normal. But if I was to have a device that was rated only down to 10 and I put a 9 through it, it may not actually stop me when I want it to.
Right.
And same thing, vice versa. If like on your sport climbing descent device, and you put an 11.5 in there, you might not even be able to go down. It will be just too much friction. So you got to keep that in mind when picking your kit.
All right. I will summarize it by saying this. Equipment is very purpose. It's very specific for the job. Weight is always going to be a factor. You're not going to get away with lightweight stuff for wilderness rescue as a general rule of thumb. There are ways to do it. There are ways to lighten your gear. Don't let chasing lighter gear compromise the safety factor and the appropriate ratings of the equipment. I see a lot of people that want to use the super lightweight. Like there's some stuff out there from companies like Kong. That stuff is awesome. And I have a bunch of it. And they make a chest ascender that's like less than the size of the palm of my hand.
That little guy.
It's not rated for heavy weight.
Okay.
When it's my fat ass plus medical gear plus, right? You have to do the math of all of your equipment and make sure that you're buying the appropriate sized or appropriate rated equipment for the mission you're trying to execute. And with that, maybe if we get comments where people want to hear more about our opinions on these things, I'm happy to help anybody out individually. If your team is buying some gear and you want to ask me questions, send us a note. The show at emsonthemountain.com, I will provide you all the inputs, but there's so much individual gear out there that I think it would be pretty hard to give anybody a definitive statement on. And I don't want to get into the boat of buy this, don't buy that. That's not my job here. My job here is just to give you the opportunity to better understand what it is your mission objective is, and then go buy purpose-built equipment that matches that objective.
And I think the only thing I would add with that is if you're in a department and it's like, hey, here's your issue harnessed by manufacturer A, it's one of the full body, big monster things, guys doing windows and 600 feet. And they say, this is the one you're going to wear. Cool. It's the one you're going to wear. Learn how to use it, maximize its capabilities to the best of your ability. Same with whatever your up and down devices are. If you're handed, yeah, Petzl rig or an ID, and you're like, wow, man, this thing's kind of big and heavy. And so, yeah, that's the one you got. Learn how to use it, all its ins and outs, because those devices I found, and they're not bad devices, don't get me wrong, but they provide the most confusion for newer users just because of the way their control system works. That if you're not used to how they work, it's going to take you some time to figure it out.
Yeah.
Same way with you're going to start using the Frog system for your Ascension. And I want to try and keep it small. So yeah, you get one of those Kong little tiny guys and then realize it won't fully seat on an 11 wheel rope.
Right.
Because it wasn't made for that. Things like that. Just don't just rush out and buy a whole bunch of new kit. They can, yeah, this is the way to go, and try to be small and light. While there are ways you can do that with other pieces of equipment, you're going to save a few ounces, maybe total a pound or two total, which that can make a difference. But the goal is to effect a successful rescue, not to be as lightweight and slim as you could possibly get without reason to. Like, the caving world is different than traditional alpine wilderness technical rescue stuff. So there's different reasons why they might have a different setup. So don't look at cavers, but man, these guys are good on rope. They can only move around up and down. It's very true. But it's a different thing. You're not also going to drag your rescue equipment in a bag behind you. So think about it.
All right. I think that's everything I wanted to say in the short term. If there's things we missed or things you want to hear about or whatever, you just want to get some personal guidance on equipment, send me a note. The show at EMS on the Mountain. We're happy to do so. And with that, Sean, do you have any final thoughts?
We didn't talk about any other personal kit. And I think we'll leave that, like I said, maybe one of those, another episode of just some of the other ancillaries, nice to haves, cordage and stuff, just because you can start getting down rabbit hole of what size and how many of what's.
Yeah, we can do a whole episode just on size and how it matters.
We're going to let that one go. But what I was going to say is I think we should do another episode on other ancillary equipment, letting this one focus on the primaries of a harness, or your standard personal protectives, helmet, gloves, eye pro stuff, and the ups and downs. And we could talk about like how much of all of this stuff should you really have hanging on your harness. Do you want to be that dude that looks really cool in pictures because you've got your harness is just full of shit and some of it you've never pulled off in 15 years of doing this.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we should do a follow-on to that. Okay. Other than that, I think we covered some of the basics. And just echo Mike. Yeah, if you got questions, please hit us up. Send us that email. We'll be glad to discuss the pros and cons of a particular piece of equipment or a technique that you're trying to use or learn or want to implement in your team, whatever it is. Let us know. We'll give you an opinion. I'm not giving you gospel. Keep that in mind. So again, don't take this back to some squad chief, captain, whatever, and saying, hey, these two assholes on the work, this is what they said we should be doing. We can then help you, provide you with more information. That's what you need.
Yeah. All right. I'm going to hit the stop button now. It's been a good time. Peace. If you have any questions or comments or ideas for show topics, you can send us an email at theshow@emsonthemountain.com or hit us up on social media. We can be found on Facebook and Instagram at EMS on the Mountain, Twitter at EMSOTM, or you can engage with us and a whole community of wilderness EMS professionals at locals.com/wilderness EMS.
Until the next episode, thanks for joining us. And until we see you on the mountain, train hard, be safe, and do good work.